Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. I hope all of you are having a good weekend wherever you may be living in the world. And I must say, when I was on the air last, we certainly got our share of some great breaking news. How so? Well, the breaking news was that Frederick Tudor was able to accomplish something even more grand. Well, he went from, starting out, you know, he went from shipping down to the Caribbean, including southern cities like Charleston, South Carolina, Savannah, Georgia, and then New Orleans, Louisiana. You know, he's had success there. But the breaking news that we learned from the previous episode was that he sent ships 16,000 miles across from the Atlantic Ocean all the way to the Indian Ocean, and he was able to successfully ship ice all the way to Calcutta, India. To me, that was quite the breaking news. But what if I told you all in this next podcast segment episode of Gavin Waitman's The Frozen Water Trade, how ice from New England lakes kept the world cool, that there's going to be some more breaking news. Breaking news for all the right reasons. Of course, you know, when I think of breaking news, 9 times out of 10, it's usually something bad. It's a shame that breaking news can't always be something that's exciting, relevant, meaningful. Well, I think it's fair to say that that the podcasts that we have been talking about, regardless of book topic episode, while yes, there is information that is considered breaking news, we could say that it's breaking news for educational reasons. Yes, some of it could be sad, but it's being taught for educational purposes. More often than not in this day and age, with the way we access news and we get breaking news, yes, it can be to tell us what's going on, but is it teaching a lesson? What are we getting out of the breaking news? In other words, what's truly constituting breaking news? I don't know. But what I do know is that when my parents were alive, and for example, when they learned about the death of President John F. Kennedy, and when my dad told me that he was in school, when he heard the news over the loudcom, my dad told me that you could hear pins dropping. People, classmates, including my dad himself, were just stunned by the news. That was breaking news. When you didn't see what had happened on television, but just to hear it for the first time was breaking news onto itself. So how we phrase breaking news and learn of breaking news has evolved immensely over time, but usually when I think of breaking news, I tend to think of it as just one thing. Nowadays, we can consider just about anything to be breaking news. Well, what I do know is that we have another great episode before us in terms of new and exciting, relevant information that will continue to guide us in the right track with where we're going. What we're going to be learning about in this podcast segment episode is an advancement in transportation. In other words, you know, what is it that Frederick Tudor and others can come up with strategy-wise to help get ice transported faster? In other words, you know, we know there are wagons out there that can haul loads of ice, but there has to be something more efficient to get ice from point A to point B domestically along the eastern seaboard of the United States. In other words, there has to be something that can perhaps get ice from point A to point B so that ice itself does not lose some of its mass, or not just some of it, but a good portion of it. In other words, we want to find something else that's going to be, it could be not only just so much cost effective, but saving time. How so? Well, you know, if you want to save on time, you have to find mechanisms, or maybe not mechanisms, but measures that can help you get to where you need to be in terms of cost-effective measures, so that not only do you have a product that still ships out, but it gets to its final destination still intact. There could be some melt of ice, but wouldn't it be fair to say that even from a domestic standpoint, that Frederick Tudor would want customers to have less than a third of ice melt or less than a fourth of ice melt? I would think so. But what I do know is that we better get the show on the road before it's too late, because we do have some breaking news to learn about, but it's breaking news for all the right reasons, for positive reasons. So here we go with our first leadoff question to this episode of Gavin Waitman's The Frozen Water Trade: How Ice from New England Lakes Kept the World Cool. Had there been a steady increase in the overall consumption of ice, most notably within the United States following the new market success 16,000 miles via waterway to Calcutta, India? Well, the answer is a definitive yes there. Given at one time early on, Frederick Tudor himself sent single ice shipment loads per year, meaning, you know, once per year, to southern cities, most notably New Orleans, Louisiana, Charleston, South Carolina, and Savannah, Georgia. Now, sending shipments once a year is a good start. But as time moved onward, and now that there are advances, most notably with the horse-drawn ice plow that was invented by Nathaniel Wyeth, whom got a patent for it in 1829, because of advancements in technology such as Nathaniel Wyeth's ice plow, ice shipments to southern U.S. port cities like New Orleans, Charleston, and Savannah now became more frequent during summertime. So we went from only having one shipment per year to now where we could be getting at most three shipments per year. That may not seem like a big increase, but to get three shipments per year of ice, that is, to me, that's a big step in terms of progress and in terms of accessibility and having perhaps a surplus of ice that might last longer, not only just for a year's time, but maybe into the start of the following year, depending upon the time that it's received, how soon it gets placed into the ice house itself, and how well it can be preserved via sawdust or insulation. So all those logistical tactics that go into making the product well worth not only investing in, but well worth preserving for long-term use. Frederick's primary source of ice still remained at Fresh Pond, which included multiple timber ice houses along with facilities per rivals practicing in the same trade. Now, we did learn early on that nobody owned any of the water itself along the ponds, the rivers, the lakes. And because nobody owns those waters, therefore, Frederick Tudor himself and anybody else who wants to participate in this trade does have access to the waters. Now, you know, yes, Frederick, we've learned all along that he's been big on getting monopolies. But if there's one thing that he has been smart enough not to have done, was to get monopolies on Fresh Pond and perhaps anywhere else in Massachusetts. Because if he did get monopolies to harvest only for his business, to be the one to be harvesting ice on Fresh Pond, then he has discouraged... not only has he discouraged the competition, but he could be burning a lot of other unnecessary bridges. But what we will also be learning about here shortly is how Frederick interacts with other competitors in the same trade, most notably along Fresh Pond. And it's actually not all bad, but it is definitely worth mentioning. So Frederick Tudor does still have, is holding on to Nathaniel Wyeth's ice plow patent, but he did not enforce it, which enabled multiple teams out on Fresh Pond once ice itself became ready. You know, yeah, he could have enforced the ice plow patent, but at the same time, if you have multiple teams out there on Fresh Pond, more teams you have out there, say, from rival companies, then the faster it might take to actually work for everyone to work together to get the job done, to where not only does the ice itself get cut from the pond, but then all the other steps that are required can move forward more promptly, to where the end results are thus meaningful. Now, once ice became harvested more regularly, did Fresh Pond soon attract migrant laborers whom came in large numbers? Yes. Come January 1837, Frederick Tudor himself counted up to 127 men, including 5 horses and 1 bull, all of whom were employed in the Fresh Pond business, as well as 60 men providing the ice. Migrant laborers, folks, that's a big thing. Often in today's time, we often think of that as something of more modern times, but even back in 19th century times, depending on where you were living, the need of migrant laborers did come into place, because they were doing work that, say, other people simply were not skilled in doing, or just maybe didn't have the desire to do it because it just wasn't their cup of tea. Now, as important as it was for Fresh Pond itself to be able to attract migrant laborers during the heart of the ice harvesting season, we do need to be reminded that regardless of the season, even if it wasn't in winter time, a smaller established workforce was always required to be present throughout the year to oversee all the ice houses, along with such procedures as loading up wagons where shipment orders came in for ice cargo loads. Boston as a city is using thousands of tons of ice per year, given that the city itself is experiencing an ever-growing demand for ice boxes, which we referred to from a previous podcast as like a mini refrigerator for its time. The ice boxes were designed, obviously, to keep beverages and perishable foods, not just frozen, but chilled for long-term purposes. So, yes, you've got this ever-growing demand for ice boxes that is continuing to grow, but there also has to be an ever-growing demand for providing steady ice supplies during the summertime to tradespeople like, butchers and dairymen who need to keep their products preserved from spoilage. Think about it. If you want your various cuts of meat to stay fresh, then you're going to need ice. Salting and smoking your meats is a good thing, but if you want something that's going to keep them fresh long-term in terms of chilling, then yes, that ice is going to have to come into play. Many cities along the eastern seaboard were heavily drawn into creating Tudor-style ice harvesting and storing practices to cutting ice via Nathaniel Wyeth's ice plow. So a lot of other people along the eastern seaboard have really gotten into this big craze, big movement. Hang tight for just a moment. We've got more exciting information to come. Earlier today, my wife and I were down in North Carolina visiting my wife's niece, along with her brother and his wife. We hadn't seen them in a few months, but it was a lot of fun. Even though it was just for part of the day, we're very fortunate that they don't live too far away from us, maybe about 2.5 hours at most. And so that means that, we're certainly able to see them frequently. But it was really great to see them. So, you know, for any of you who are listening, if you have family that's not too far away, you know, certainly make the effort to visit whenever you can. It's one thing to be an hour or two away, but, you know, yes, life can get in the way sometimes. But knowing that if you're not far away, still take advantage of it, because none of us know sometimes what tomorrow might bring, not to scare anybody, but it is just good to know that if loved ones aren't that far away, you know, make sure you do what you can to keep in touch with them. Now, given Fresh Pond consisted of many rivals working alongside Frederick Tudor, were any stipulations or agreements already put into place? Stipulations, think about like provisions, given that Fresh Pond consisted of many rivals working alongside Frederick, do any of you all think that there were any stipulations or agreements that had been put into place? Well, there was one such agreement that was already put into place. It held that anyone whom owned part of Fresh Pond's shoreline had the rights to cut ice per the specific sector of the pond which touched up along the border within their property's confines. Okay, so if you are right along the shoreline of Fresh Pond and your property is basically adjacent to the pond, and say you have less than 10 acres of shoreline, you do have whatever number of acres you are working with, then you are entitled to harvest that particular set of acreage. Matter of fact, we'll talk more about that here in just a moment. But early on, there weren't many issues or conflicts, I should say, given that in a good winter season, more ice could be gathered. But come 1840, one ice farmer, his name wasn't mentioned, but one ice farmer in particular, whom owned a section of shoreline along Fresh Pond, he went about constructing a large ice house to where it appeared he was cutting more than his equal share. So I think it's one thing to have an ice house, but if you are building a supersized ice house and it's bigger than everyone else's, it's going to give everyone else the impression that you're trying to cut more ice than they are. And it's also giving everyone else the impression that manipulate. You're trying to monopolize. You're trying to take the thunder out of everyone else. You're trying to derail any kind of competition. You're trying to derail any kind of equal access that others would be able to have in terms of harvesting Fresh Pond via frozen ice. So, yes, this ice farmer went about constructing a large ice house to where it appeared he was cutting more than his equal share of ice. And so for everyone else, it led them to believe that if this problem continued to go unchecked, it would lead to further disputes over property ownership of ice. So, this obviously raises a red flag for Frederick Tudor and for Nathaniel Wyeth. What do you think Nathaniel Wyeth proposed doing? He proposed, or I should say requested, that all harvesters must agree to call in an arbiter. Well, an arbiter, or I should say a mediator, someone whom has primary authority behind resolving disputes. You know, yes, we'd like to think that people themselves can resolve matters without needing to get a mediator or, worst case scenario, a lawyer in to fix the dispute. But there probably was a time when everybody could do that kind of thing and not have to get a mediator or someone of high level authority involved. Not that that's a bad thing, but it's probably fair to say that there have been times throughout history when we have not been able to resolve problems on our own where it did not need to involve the presence of a of someone of a legal jurisdiction. So they did turn to an arbiter, or I should say a mediator. And before I get to the next question here, there is an interesting fact I should point out that in colonial times, 90% of the American population was living on living in rural areas on farms. As a matter of fact, it was a book that had to do with about Chief Justice John Marshall, who was Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court from 1801 to 1835. But at one time, only about 10%, I think I want to say it was at least 10%, then 10% at best of people living at the time took matters into a courtroom to resolve. So think about it. Those whom took matters into a courtroom for last resort means, they were usually people who probably had money at best, people who could afford a lawyer. Most people in colonial times, if they were in trouble with the law, they ended up having to represent themselves. If you were in trouble with the law and, you know, you were someone of high-end status in terms of gentry or, say, upper middle class or middle class, I guess I should say, you probably could get yourself a lawyer to defend you in court. But the majority of people whom had to defend themselves, whom went to court, if they could not afford a lawyer, they were representing themselves because they simply did not have the means to hire someone else to represent them on their behalf. So it might be fair to say that for some of these other people, even in the 19th century, they probably don't have the means to hire a lawyer on their own end, but they can get someone such as a mediator whom can look after everyone in terms of resolving disputes to where everyone in the end can walk away feeling better about something than they previously did earlier. So here's our next question then. Whom did ice harvesters turn to for resolving disputes per amount of shoreline owned by each man involved in the trade along Fresh Pond? They turned to Harvard Law School professor Simon Greenleaf, whom ruled, or I should say determined, that each harvester's share of winter ice must be based on total length of the shoreline, that is, the total length of shoreline on Fresh Pond, for which they owned, regardless of overall size and property that lie near or around the pond. I'm not a legal expert, but this was just the best way I could sum it up based upon the research that I had done regarding this. So, yes, each harvester's share of winter ice was to be based upon the total length of shoreline that they owned, regardless of overall size. So to better modify this existing matter, a surveyor got assigned to make a detailed map of Fresh Pond, which included lines that were drawn defining boundaries of ownership. The map itself got published in 1841, which held Frederick Tudor and Nathaniel Wyeth as the largest owners. Frederick Tudor, folks, believe it or not, owned 48 acres on Fresh Pond. Nathaniel Wyeth had 44. So basically, both men were just shy of the 50-acre threshold. And I'll tell you all here soon just how many other men were part of this business on Fresh Pond and in terms of how much acreage they had. But they basically had to come to a compromise based upon how much each harvester's share of winter ice yielded would be ultimately based upon the total length of shoreline that they owned. So whenever ice itself was a foot thick, how many tons of ice could get cut from 1 acre? Believe it or not, roughly 1,000 tons worth of ice could get cut from 1 acre whenever the ice itself was a foot thick. That's pretty awesome fact, to say the least. I did read somewhere some years back that that in order for a lake or a pond or a river to completely freeze, there needs to be at least three good frosts. There really needs at least three good hard frosts to where the temperature is frigid enough to where a body of water can actually be able to freeze over. And I want to say maybe about anywhere from 3 to 6 inches of frozen solid ice can support 1 to 2 people. But there needs to be at least 10 to 12 inches of solid ice at best to support a pickup truck that is equipped for being out on that kind of hard frozen solid water, especially when it comes to something like ice fishing. So just because a body of water may be coated with ice on the top or on the surface, it doesn't automatically mean it's safe to go out into the middle of the body of water and just walk along it as though under this assumption that, you know, nothing's going to break. In other words, it's not going to crack. I'm not going to fall through. Well, even ice itself has a mind of its own. You know, it can be very brittle, and if it opens up and you fall through, it could be a matter of minutes. You know, life and death in a matter of minutes. Because what people don't realize is that when you fall through the ice, and if it's that cold, it's like 1,000 knives stabbing at you. You know, and hypothermia can set in very quickly too. So there are a lot of unknown factors that we sometimes underestimate, and that's part of, you know, where Mother Nature can get in the way and say, "Hey, look, you know, ice. There might be ice above, but you don't know how thick that ice is." Just because there's ice there, it doesn't mean it's automatically safe to walk along the surface. So, yes, to think that whenever ice itself being a foot thick, to know that you could cut roughly about 1,000 tons worth of ice out of 1 acre, that's pretty doggone impressive, to say the least. Per a good winter, ice harvesters could expect a potential crop yield of around 40,000 tons each from fresh pond alone. Per a good winter year, folks. So you get 40,000 tons each from fresh pond alone. You are, I think you could say you're rolling in the dough or in the money. Well, besides Frederick Tudor and Nathaniel Wyeth, 7 other owners held property along Fresh Pond, being less than 10 acres. It may not seem like the grandest amount compared to what Frederick Tudor and Nathaniel Wyeth had, but just to have at least just shy of 10 acres, that's a big deal. And the fact is that everybody's still getting their fair share of not just so much the market, but they're getting their fair share of being able to participate in this ice trade along Fresh Pond, thanks in part to what the arbiter ruled upon, being that of Harvard Law School professor Simon Greenleaf, and that each harvester's share of winter ice was to be based upon the total length of shoreline they owned, regardless of overall size and property that lied near or around the pond. Well, that compromise to me is better than having no agreement whatsoever. Well, here's where the breaking news really can kick into full gear. What new method of transportation in the United States began kicking into full-scale gear come the 1830s? Think about it here for just a second. I bet a lot of you probably already know it, but I'm going to give you a moment to think about it, so hang tight. How about the railroad industry? That's right, folks. The railroad industry gets kicking into gear during the 1830s. Now, the first railroad company that came about actually started in 1828, the B&O, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. Matter of fact, he was the last signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was alive, still living in 1828, because Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died on July 4th of 1826. I've probably mentioned his name many of times before, but we do need to keep him as a reminder, because it's so easy for all of us to think that John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were the last two signers to die, but Mr. Charles Carroll of Carrollton, Maryland, was the last signer to die, and he died in 1832 at the age of 95. He was the only Roman Catholic signer of the Declaration of Independence, but he was on the inaugural board committee that helped get the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad established, and he did this at the age of 91. I tell you, it never hurts to stay active, and it never hurts to keep your mind moving all the time. So it's fair to say that Mr. Carroll probably did not miss out on anything in his lifetime up until he passed away. But yes, in the 1830s, the railroad industry is making its significance, or I should say presence, known. Now, as for being in Massachusetts, in the year 1837, Boston, Massachusetts got a rail line built, which helped link its granite quarries to the wharves. And the wharves are another term for shoreline structures that enabled vessels to load and unload cargoes, most notably, in this case, with the rail line going all the way into Charlestown. So the rail line itself, it's not far from Fresh Pond, but it ended 4 miles short of where the water body stood or was located. So, man, to think that this rail line ends just 4 miles short of where Fresh Pond stands. I know that if I was in Frederick Tudor or in Nathaniel Wyeth's shoes, you've got to be thinking to yourselves, hey, what is it that we can do on our end to see about expanding the rail line all the way to where Fresh Pond is? Not just so much for our benefit, but perhaps to improve the overall transporting of ice. So here we go with our next question. Did Frederick Tudor and Nathaniel Wyeth advocate the extension of the Charlestown Railroad into such bodies of water as Fresh and Spy Ponds? Yes, both men, including other advocates, or I should say supporters, vouched that railroads could reduce the overall cost of harvesting ice by a third, to reducing loss from the time ice got first cut and stored to all the way to its final delivery into Charlestown. Well, we've got to, let's do some studying here. How is it that Frederick Tudor and Nathaniel Wyeth know this stuff? Well, based upon past operations, they have come to realize that the majority of the ice lost occurred when hauling it by track and road to Boston Harbor. 40,000 tons, that's the number or amount harvested regularly for export purposes, whereas domestic consumption was taken in heavy wagons carrying up to 5 tons each. And it's one thing to transport ice by wagons, folks, but what disadvantages do wagons have? Well, wagons have difficulties in navigating the roads. Well, you know, if there's been a bad rainstorm, you know, the rains, you get a bad rainstorm, that could wash out a road to where navigating the roadways become virtually impossible. It's bad enough the ground is saturated, but it's going to make getting the wagons from point A to point B all the more unbearable. And then all of a sudden, if you are, even if the weather hasn't been crappy, but you're trying to get from point A to point B by roadway, there's no guarantee that that something might happen to where if a wheel comes off, I mean, sure, you would have some backup wheels with you that you could reattach to replace the one that came off. But there again, you're losing time. And it's not just so much you're losing time, but what about that cargo? You know, this is cargo that's not going to stay intact for the next 10 hours if you don't get it to its final place. You know, you don't want to lose, you don't want to lose the cargo altogether via melting. So in other words, it's not just losing the cargo itself, but if the wagons are having difficulties in navigating the roads, that means holding up the ships and their crews, which ultimately places the burdens on the ice harvesters themselves, which means they have to pay out more money than originally expected. So if the ships and their crews are waiting on the docks longer than necessary, then they're losing out on time as well. They have deadlines to meet. So it is fair to say that Frederick Tudor and Nathaniel Wyeth have a very good point. They have very good points behind their cause. They're trying to find a way to not losing further ice, but they're also trying to find a way to speed the process so that it could get to its end point and ultimately to its final destination, whether it's to another place domestically in the United States or elsewhere, like in the West Indies or across the ocean as far away as Calcutta or Bombay, India. Well, besides cutting, shaping, storing, to moving the ice itself, what other costs were associated with the trade? These are some really good ones here. These other costs that got associated with the trade ranged from hay, chaffing, or I might say chafing, that's debris separation, to sawdust, wood particles used for insulating ice. All sawdust was purchased from timber mills up north from the state of Maine at an annual cost of $16,000. From 1837 to 1840, the Boston ice trade had nearly doubled from 18,700 tons exported in 1837 to 32,297 tons transported per 140 vessels in 1840. I tell you, this has been phenomenal to see the growth. You know, it's been, almost 35 years now since Frederick Tudor made that first voyage from Boston to St. Pierre, Martinique, and he only made a $2,000 profit. He's really learned a lot over the years. And it's fair to say that he's still learning new stuff because this is a very delicate trade. He has proven many skeptics wrong, most notably those within the inner circle of the Brahmin elite, but even they've now come to the realization that maybe they were wrong to judge him and that this guy really has proven himself worthy. He's basically saved his family. His family was almost on the brink of bankruptcy. He got them out of bad financial turmoil. Did Frederick Tudor and Nathaniel Wyeth, including their supporters, ultimately win the right to have the Charlestown Railroad extended into Fresh and Spy Ponds? Yes, they did. The first train load of ice departed Fresh Pond for Charlestown shoreline come December of 1841 per specially insulated trucks designed by Nathaniel Wyeth. I can only imagine witnessing the first train load of ice departing Fresh Pond for Charlestown. I mean, just to see that all taking place, I mean, that is breaking news, and I bet that was probably reported in the newspaper to read about it. And I'm sure there were people who thought to themselves, how in the world could they be transporting ice in a train? Well, they did find, as I mentioned a second ago, specially insulated trucks that kept the ice preserved intact, kept it cool. I mean, you know, we don't have to go to the 20th century times for advanced means of refrigeration to where we can do all of this. Matter of fact, folks, even in the 19th century, we are learning that they found ways to preserve ice. It took a lot of skill. It took a lot of practice. But Frederick Tudor is making it happen. We have seen it. Now, as advantageous as the steam trains were, there is a disadvantage. It is a disadvantage that probably Tudor and Wyeth and others will have to accept. But, I mean, they know that there are risks involved. Of course, there are no such things as environmentalists. So, if there were people back then considered as environmentalists of the time, they probably would have opposed the idea of having a railroad coming through. How so? Well, the steam trains were responsible for introducing hazards to timber ice houses, like emitting sparks, to releasing vapor. Well, emitting sparks, you know, if the wind is right, if the movement of the wind is right, guess what? It can carry those sparks into a direction, into the same direction where the ice house structure lies. And if those sparks land on the ice house, they can, and if the temperature is right, they can pretty much lit up a building, set it ablaze to where there's nothing left. It's completely charred. We should be reminded, even in colonial times, folks, that kitchens were not in the same room as the main house. Why is that? You put your kitchen in a separate, if you were wealthy enough, and even middling families did this too, but you kept your kitchen in a separate structure. This way, if there was a fire in the kitchen, it was separate from the main house. And plus, too, by putting your kitchen in a separate building, if it was windy out, the winds might blow in a different direction, but they would not blow perhaps in the direction towards the house, to where perhaps the smoke, if it made its way into the main compartment of the house or the main section of the house, then the house itself could be vulnerable. So not placing everything in one house was not a bad idea. If you had the means to have multiple units or facilities, then by all means, you would keep your kitchen separate. So this way, not everything would go up in flames at once. I know it sounds a little odd to get off track about it, but yes, as advantageous as it was to have had a steam train, the thought of introducing hazards, or hazards that posed a threat to timber ice houses, like emitting sparks to releasing vapors. Yeah, the last thing you don't want to have happen, even with vapors getting released, is that they come into contact with ice that is still at an ice house. Is that vapor going to be in contact with sawdust and other means of insulation? And if so, how much ice is going to get lost because of exposure to vapor, to where it will start melting much faster than originally anticipated? Now, come 1847, how many tons of ice got shipped down the coast to 28 different towns in the United States? Think about this one for a moment. It's a pretty hefty number, but it's a grand one. The answer is 52,000 tons of ice that got shipped down the coast to 28 different towns in the United States. That is pretty doggone amazing. Well, when I think of established cities with established ice markets by 1847, I think of New Orleans, Louisiana, Charleston, South Carolina, and Savannah, Georgia. But there are some other cities that are making their presence known as becoming top established ice markets. How about Washington, D.C.? That's right, folks. America's capital has now become an established ice market. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That's still a thriving city. I mean, after all, shoot, Philadelphia was America's largest city at the time that the United States Declaration of Independence was signed, and the same for the Constitution. I want to say around the time that the Constitution was signed that there were about 40,000 people living in Philadelphia, if that tells you anything right there. I was also surprised to learn that Mobile, Alabama was an established ice market, a city with an established ice market, as well as Key West, Florida, and Norfolk, Virginia, which is probably about 2 hours from where I live. I thought Key West was also interesting, too, because when I think of Key West, Florida in the 19th century, I think of a fellow named Henry Flagler, who was responsible for developing rail service that ultimately connected the Florida Keys to the mainland of Florida, most notably going into Miami northward into other parts of the Sunshine State via the mainland. But yes, Key West, Florida had become a top established city for having an ice market. But in 1847, there were 258 vessels transporting ice domestically via the coastal trade, whereas 23,000 tons of ice were transported in 95 ships to foreign ports. Cargoes of ice were sent to more than half a dozen West Indies islands, as well as all the way to Hong Kong, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Frederick Tudor, folks, is really setting a true example of what the American dream is all about, especially when it has involved transporting a commodity that many others, you know, scoffed at years ago, saying, you know, it's one thing to watch this frozen cargo get loaded only to see it be melted and wondering, is it going to get to its end destination still intact, or is it going to be, or when it gets arrived to the end destination, will it be all be melted away to where there's no profit in return? Well, Frederick Tudor is he's made a lot of profits. He's proven the skeptics wrong. Now, prior to the ice trade taking place, had sawdust in Maine been worthy of anything? Had it been worth anything, I should say? Believe it or not, folks, sawdust had not been worth anything. Why is this even important? Well, I'll tell you why sawdust is important, but let's focus on the first part of this as to why it had not been worth anything at one time before the ice trade came about. Well, given, for one, it had been known to grow frequently in Maine's rivers, and secondly, unchecked growth of sawdust in Maine's rivers resulted in the trapping of sediments and nutrients, thus disrupting various rivers in the state of Maine. It disrupted their ecosystems that ultimately led to eventual flooding. As the ice trade business came about, leaders like Tudor and Wyeth, they saw something unique about sawdust. Well, sawdust itself got reinvented to where it had greater value as a commodity. Sawdust was getting sold at $2.50 a thread, or I should say rope, to Boston ice merchants. Boston ice merchants, folks, saw sawdust as a means of preserving the ice. The summer months saw consistent deliveries of ice to people living in Boston, including outlying areas. The year 1847 saw Boston's overall ice consumption at 27,000 tons, which exceeded its entire total export trade. Issues pertaining to poor harvests during mild winters got solved due in part to constructing large storage ice houses for greater storage capacity purposes. As the 1840s came to an end, had Frederick Tudor himself become wealthy? Yes, but his fortune centered around property investments versus profits from ice trade. Okay, so by this time, as the 1840s are coming to an end, he's got different investments. I mean, yes, he's still participating in the ice trade, but the investments, in terms of their fortunes, it's around property, all things property, versus the ice trade. Keeping up with demand for ice shipment cargoes meant buying land for new loadings per ports where ice got delivered. Well, basically what that means is that, okay, for whatever new places Frederick Tudor is going to have order requests going to for shipping ice, he's got to think about purchasing land that not only will be designed for building an ice house or two there, but lodgings perhaps for those whom are going to be stationed down there who will oversee the construction of the ice houses, but also would assist the crew coming in by boat to the port, say, of New Orleans or the port of Mobile, Alabama, with the assisting of the unloading of ice into the ice house facilities. So in other words, they've got to have lodgings for these people. You know, these people aren't just going to be able to go down on their own probably and say, hey, where's the best place for me to stay until I'm ready to go with assisting X number of boats with ice coming into Mobile by such and such time. In 1849, Frederick owned five lodgings in New Orleans, one in Charleston, and a brick ice store in Kingston, Jamaica. He bought 158 acres and two houses at Fresh Pond. The land at Fresh Pond was $130 an acre. In 1849, Frederick, he was 66 years old, folks, and he was married. I'm sure many of you were wondering, did this guy even marry, or was he a bachelor? He was married, and he had four young children, folks. I don't even think by this point in time in 1849 if the oldest is even 10 years old just yet. But he has four children. He's in the works of building his estate at Nahant. And it was during this time that he really expressed concerns about what would happen to his family should he suddenly die. And he's got reasons to believe that because, you know, what's going to happen to me if I died unexpectedly? How's my family going to be taken care of? But he's still very optimistic in the present moment. He's still very optimistic as to what the ice industry itself will continue to bring going forward in the future. But little could he ever imagine in his own mind by 1849 that 12 years later the United States would be engaged in a civil war separating all the free states, being the non-slave states, with those whom are slave amongst those whom are slave states. I know it would be fair to say that if any of us were living during that time, we would certainly have not wanted there to have been a war between the states. But I think it's fair to say that for many others, that by 1849, going into 1850, that it might just be only a matter of time before a war itself does break out. I do know that in 1850, California was admitted into the United States as the 31st state. When California was admitted into the Union as the 31st state, that left an unbalanced distribution of free states versus slave states. There was a compromise in 1850. It was referred to as the Compromise of 1850. It basically kept California from not becoming a slave state. But I do know that it was the last true attempt to keep slavery out of politics. Not trying to get off course, folks. But Fred, the bottom line is that Frederick Tudor lived to see this, and he was alive during the Civil War. Not to get ahead of things, folks, but let's just try to put ourselves in his shoes and envision what is taking place in America as we're on the eve of finishing out the 1840s and going into the 1850s. Here we have all this success with shipping a commodity that others, that so many others just didn't think could happen. And yet here we are struggling as a nation to try to avert going to war. But for every free state that gets admitted into the Union, a slave state has to be added just to keep the number of free and slave states equal. You know, it could be seen as an unfair compromise of sorts, but it was probably the best that politicians were able to do during that time. But anyways, what I do know is that we have wrapped up this podcast segment episode, and when I'm on the air again next, we're going to talk about something very exciting. Well, all of this has been exciting, but what we're going to talk about is a lake known as Wenham Lake. And it is a lake that still exists in Massachusetts today. It's north of Boston, but it's a lake that has a story onto itself involving ice for all of us to enjoy learning about. So that wraps it up for this episode. And thank you again for being such ardent listeners. And wherever you all may live, continue to stay safe. Take care.